Hello, and welcome to the Mystagogy Podcast, hosted by the Adult Faith Programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. In Greek, the word mystagogy means leading through the mysteries. In the earliest centuries of Christianity, mystagogy referred to the practice of helping Christians to appreciate more deeply the Christian mysteries into which they had been initiated by baptism, confirmation, and reception of the Eucharist. This present program of mystagogy is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. In this first presentation on Dante's Paradiso, Barbara covers the first 8 cantos of the poet's journey through heaven.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. And 2 weeks, it feels like 100 years because I'm so used to seeing you all every week. So 2 weeks is just, I'm going through with the withdrawal. But okay, so knife break and then coming back into heaven here. And this is a tough work, the Paradiso. And I say there's something more for me anyway, maybe it's just me, but I get the hell thing so much better than I do the heaven one and the purgatory. And he says this, it's very strange, but in Canto 2, I think he begs you to stop reading. He's only read this if you are really serious. Otherwise, stop reading. It's going to be too much for you. And when do you ever see that in a book where the writers, please don't read any more of this. But anyway, he's aware that it's a very heady work. And so we'll talk a little bit about why that is and but basically I have to say, spending 2 days reading it and prepping here, I did feel so much joy in my heart. And reading, we had Laetare Sunday yesterday, I was just thinking of heaven because I'm spending this time thinking here. So hopefully you get something out of it too. But one of the neat things for Dante is the maps, visualize the map of hell, you know, visualize the map of purgatory, right? And then the map of heaven is basically this, the planets. And he's got a little bit more too in it, but we're going to go out into the heavens. And it adds this other whole level to the Lord's Prayer. Because for Dante, he wants you to think, as it is in the heavens, like your will be done as it is in the heavens, on earth as it is in the heavens. And so we're going to look at that, say, what is he saying? What is he seeing there? But anyway, so here's the map. So basically, here's heaven. That's purgatory down there. And then you have this like ocean voyage kind of thing, which is really... they get sucked up, like the speed of light. They get sucked up, and then boom, they're in this realm of heaven. Actually, there's the journey between hell and purgatory. Then you have the earthly paradise. So that's where we left them. They were in Eden again. And then they get sucked in and up into outer space. Okay, and this rainbow thing is the levels of heaven, but it's really, you're going planet by planet, okay? So there's another way to look at it here. And then when you get to the very end, you hit the mystical rose, which is the point of it all, that we are all petals in this great flower. And then God himself is beholding this mystical rose. And so just super lovely at the end. Okay. But okay. In the same way that I did with hell and purgatory, I'm just going to lay out a few principles for understanding heaven as Dante is seeing it here that will be applied to everything. But the first principle, as he says in the first canto, it's the longest prayer for help that he has. And I think there's 9 times in the Divine Comedy where Dante asks God to help him describe the things he's seeing. In hell, it does it a couple times, like, this is so bad, there are no words for how bad, God, you have to help me. And then in purgatory, there's a few places. And then in heaven, and so the heaven one is the longest. This is impossible to describe what I'm trying to say to you. And so he says this, within that heaven, which most his light receives was I. This language is very much hearkens to St. Paul when he says, and I was raised up into the third heaven. It's very similar language, huh? And things beheld, which to repeat, nor knows nor can. I don't know how to say it. I don't. And if I did know how to say it, I wouldn't have the ability. If I knew what to say, I wouldn't know how. Who from above descends? Because in drawing near to its desire, our intellect engulfs itself so far that after it, the memory cannot go. So he's saying, my mind is so overflowing with what I experienced in heaven that my memory is spotty because it didn't understand what it was going through. So I have these impressions only. and he's so eloquent that you're starting to wonder when you read this, did he really have some visions? Or is this just, he's really just getting into the whole being a poet thing and pretending he's doing this. But his language is really steeped in the language of somebody who's been through something that it makes you wonder. Okay, so yeah. So why are we in space in Paradiso? Because the stars are perfectly ordered and the planets. I'm going to say this wrong, but I'm going to give you the quick version here of what, if I'm reducing his beautiful prose down, that Beatrice says to him, look at the perfection of the heavens. Raise your eyes up and just look at it. And they don't crash into each other. And they're regular. And we can set a calendar by them. And they're ordered and they have their trajectory. And so she said, this is the place, the heavens are the place untainted by human sin, where everything works the way it's supposed to. And so this prayer then becomes, may it be done in me as it is in the heavens. I started saying the Lord's Prayer myself a little bit, and a little bit that, like, may your will be done in me as it is in heaven. Just to really keep it, because it's easy to say, may it be done on earth. That's not my problem. But maybe we can just start with me, right? One of the cool things, though, is, again, when Beatrice is showing Dante, the pilgrim, the heavens, trying to get him to get the majesty and the beauty of it. And she's like, basically, look up. And so I was thinking about this. Look up when you're down. Look up when you're down. Really do it. One time when I was in college, I was going out with this guy and he was into astrology and astronomy. And so he said, we're going to go out and look at the stars. And I'm like, whatever. Okay. But he said, we're going to lay down here in the ground. It's New Hampshire in November. So it was cold, but we had our... I remember laying in my sleeping bag and we're looking up at the stars and he goes, you're going to get dizzy, I promise. And said, just look at the stars for 20 minutes. So we did, just lay there. Now, these stars are going, the earth is traveling so fast. And so the panoply of the heavens, it's moving by you. And if you just stare at it. So then he said, okay, stand up now. And I stood up and sure enough, I was dizzy. You should try it sometime. It's really magnificent that it's like that you get a sense of the planet moving so fast. But Beatrice is basically making this case that if you can raise your eyes to the heavens, you will feel better about what's going on the earth. And so try doing it. And I love where I live now. I lived in Los Angeles for 23 years, and the only stars I could see were like on the red carpet. But now I can go in my backyard and there's no lights. So it's just the heavens in front of us. So beautiful. So there it is. Okay. So that idea of the perfection of the celestial bodies, it's a place untainted by human sin, is supposed to inspire. That's how it's supposed to be. That's how things are supposed to function. Okay. Now, we talked about hell is the place where everybody's thinking wrongly, and purgatory is the place where people are coming to realize that they're wrong about things. Heaven is the place where it's going to be right thinking. So pretty much every canto is, you get a little intro and then a work of theology. And on a lot of very abstruse dogmatic problems that you're like, wow. And he goes on and on. And Beatrice is usually the one explaining it, which I kind of love, a woman in the 14th century being the teacher. But still, he's pretty much every level, there's another theological problem that is going to be discussed in the name of truth. And that this is seeing everything clearly. And so it's a tough work for that. But it's cool the way he does answer a lot of the questions, because it's a little bit unconventional. Okay, now I just found this. I love this painter. His name is Hansen. It's a more contemporary painter, but he does stuff with light that I love. But in heaven, so this is a scholar, Barbara Villacott. I trust anyone named Barbara. But she said this. She said, within Paradiso, love and beauty are threaded together with light. So everywhere remember in hell, sin was generally about noise and ugliness and smells. Like those things were wedded together. In heaven, love and beauty and light are always going to be thread together. So God's love is making light, that's understanding, and the beautiful possible and happen. And so you're going to see that over and over again as you go through heaven, that as we come to understand things, then there's always some kind of beautiful natural metaphor, or again, the heavens, and then it's always light. Okay. All right. Now, the souls in heaven. So we said the souls in hell were all crazy, right? The souls in purgatory are repentant. The souls in heaven, first and foremost, are unrecognizable. So Dante meets people he knew in life, but he's like, I think I know you. And it harkens to the resurrection stories. It's always struck me that at least I think four times in the resurrection narratives in the Gospels, people don't recognize Jesus. And then, you know, the two on the way to Emmaus are talking about him. And then he walks with them for an hour and they don't recognize him. The apostles, when he first comes in, they think it's a ghost. Mary Magdalene is looking for him and she doesn't recognize him. And John, when the apostles are out fishing, and finally John, they're like, oh, it's the Lord. And it's like, what is going on there? Dante's explanation is this beautiful thing that in heaven, we are our unmarred essence shining brightly through with nothing to hide it. So the thing that God fell in love with when he made you, that he got the idea of you and said, I have to make that, bursts out in heaven. It's completely unhidden. The glory of your, at the core of your being, the thing God fell in love with. Number two, there's no death or decay. And then think of the other things that mar us, huh? It's perfect peace and rest. So think of how the lack of peace and rest makes us look the way we look. And no stress or fear. How does stress and fear make us look the way we look? Huh? And then no weakness, imperfection, or infirmity. That all of these things are going to result in us not looking at all the way we look. My father died last January, and one of my sisters, who he died in her arms, and she she was very freaked out by it for a few months. But then she came downstairs in, I think it was June, and said, I had a dream about Dad last night. He came to me, and she said, he came to me in a dream. And I was like, really? And this sister is not the most religious of us at all. In fact, not. But she said, he was so beautiful and handsome. I've never seen him look like that. She said, it was, the closest was the pictures of him when he was in college or in the army that we have. But still, he looked so happy. And then he said to her, I'm in heaven now because your mother and I made the nine first Fridays. And then she said to me, my sister, what is the nine first Fridays? That's how I knew it was real. And she couldn't make that up, right? But that story of her saying, Dad, I knew it was Dad, but he didn't look anything like what he looked like here. So Dante is saying that the life which had been concentrated in the life of God, which had been concentrated in the soul alone. So sanctifying grace is just pouring into your soul and keeping you going. He says, now overflows to the whole body, giving it life, beauty, and glory, causing it to thrill with inexpressible joy. That in heaven, God's life, sanctifying grace, is going to be completely unobstructed. And it will just be pouring through us. This is when we think the resurrected body of Christ, right? Light, and it can go through walls, and it can whatever, it can fly. But this idea of that life of God pouring through us unobstructed is what we're going to see. In the same way that the souls in hell never tell the truth, the souls in heaven tell way more than the truth. They're very honest and vulnerable. They have nothing to fear, and they are so happy to be where they are that what their whole story is a reason to be glory. You know, I always tell you, don't curse your journey. The souls in heaven are not cursing their journey. They're like glad for their journey, even as it took them a ways to get to God. But they're there now. Okay. Now, this one's a hard one. And in fact, it becomes a little crisis point for Dante the Pilgrim in level one of heaven, when he realizes there are levels in heaven. And he doesn't like this at all. Who does? No, right? And so basically, the first three levels of heaven are the ones that are shadowed by the earth. This is the moon, Mercury, and Venus. These three planets are shadowed by the earth. And so basically, the souls there have a little bit of shadow in their story that it kept them from ascending higher up. So basically, you have those who didn't fulfill their vows, those who say earthly ambitions too strong. It's those who sought earthly justice, and then it became about their own honor more than God's glory. And then those with too great an inclination towards Eros, basically, these are people who loved a little bit too much. Right? Now, the interesting thing is, these are mainly, when you listen to these people in these levels of heaven, it's mainly sins of omission than it is sins of commission. And we'll talk about that in a second. But this is, so Dante the Pilgrim says to Beatrice, yeah, I'm not too comfortable with this different levels of heaven thing. I thought once we made it in, we're all now in and everything. And she's, well, she always is with him. But she explains it kind of like this, that everyone in heaven is perfectly happy. They're like, their cup is full. But not everybody's cup is the same size. That is part of the choices we make in life have eternal consequences, even in heaven. And Dante's going to say that there are saints. So we're going to see the couple of them. The reason they're not higher up is because they didn't follow an invitation that would have led them to martyrdom. And they were like, yeah, no, right? And God doesn't require us to be saints or heroes. But if you are a saint or a hero, yeah. I don't know, if I were Mother Teresa and I looked over and saw me sitting next to me at the table in the eternal banquet, I would be like, I'm sorry, I don't know you. And I would be like, yes, I know. But I think about it, this idea of there are things we do on earth that allow us to see more of the beatific vision, that we're refining our sight. So somebody like me, I need a beautiful sunset and the stars to see God. Mother Teresa was seeing God in a maggot-ridden, smelly, dead, dying person in the gutter. She saw Jesus there. So her perception of God is like much bigger than mine. And the choices that she made have then eternal consequences. Okay. I don't know how I feel about this, but this is what he says, okay? All right, now, he uses this word, the Empyrean. It's the same word as empire, but this is God's house. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I'm going to go back, yeah.
See, not comfortable with this. Is this idea, for example, consistent with Catholic teaching in theology? Is it kind of running parallel to it?
Yeah.
It could be this way, but it doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah, that second one. There really isn't a lot of dogmatic teaching on what heaven is, because we really don't know. There's theological opinions. Yeah, so Dante's kind of work it out, as he has been doing in all three levels. He's, what must this be like? So this idea, so he spends a lot of time, for example, explaining how is it possible that we are seeing bodies having sensation in the next life when they don't really have bodies, you know, but we see how can people be suffering in hell and purgatory, and then how can they be experiencing pleasure and joy in heaven? They don't have bodies. And Beatrice basically says, yeah, they don't really, but it's all being done for your benefit. That's what you're seeing. And yet, you know, that it's an internal thing. So anyway, I think he lays out what makes sense, that there is, that why would there not be eternal ramifications in heaven of the way we lived our lives? That's basically what he's thinking. But it's not that the church teaches anything on it. So blissfully, you can think what you want.
Were there any parts of this whole thing that the church said, no, it's not really?
No, no. He died excommunicated, but that's because the Pope was mad at his hometown, not because of basically every Florentine was excommunicated. But no, the church never condemned his work at all. Yeah, it's a poem. And he takes cover under that. Whenever you start to say to him, wait a minute, is this really what the Bible says? He goes, hey, it's a poem. It's a poem. So don't, just chill. Okay.
The thing that gets me is we've always been told that God has prepared a room.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that room going to be the same room as my brother?
Yeah.
Or my sister, or is it going to be just mine?
We don't know. We don't know. And that question of is it possible for some souls to enjoy more than others?
I don't believe that.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. We are allowed to disagree. So we don't know. But anyway, Dante thinks that there is going to be an order to heaven too. Okay. All right. So the Empyrean is from the Greek word for pyre. This is like the funeral pyre where they would burn the bodies, huh? But it's this purifying fire. And this is the word he's going to use for heaven, that heaven is the Empyrean of God. It's God's neighborhood. And it's light the light is coming from the fire of God's love, and it's this purifying fire that pervades heaven. It's interesting, isn't it? Because he didn't have a lot of fire in hell. Remember, hell was mostly cold. But in heaven, he's got all the fire. Very cool, huh? Okay, now, so this is a theologian, Scardzini, says this, and it is called the Empyrean, which is as much as to say the heaven glowing with fire or heat, not that there is material fire or heat therein, but spiritual, which is holy love or charity. That's what pervades God's neighborhood. Okay. Now, I love this. This, excuse the little red thing. It's Sandro Botticelli. And it's his painting of Canto 32. But this gives you a sense of the Empyrean and the way Dante keeps saying it's light. It's light. And so when Botticelli read this and then he tried to paint it, this is what he came up with. But it's cool because if you look at the rest of his work, it's so full of stuff and all these things. And he's like, no, in heaven, everything is just light and then clear. And this is basically a painting of Bernard of Clairvaux talking to Dante and Beatrice about the reality of heaven in some way, but this is a different world. It's even our artists and our painters, it's like they can do clouds or this when you think of heaven. You have Jesus, eye has not seen, ear has not heard what God has ready for those who love him. Even Christ couldn't come up with a metaphor. Okay. Anyway, this line here, this is from Canto 33. So he says, in its depths, so he's looking through heaven at this point. This is the very end of the work. And he's looking back and he's looking at heaven. He says, in its depths, I saw contained by love into a single volume bound, the pages scattered through the universe. I love this line. So in other words, God's love is on the pages. And it's like a book has been unbound and all the pages have scattered all through time and place in the universe. And every page is God's love. And so in heaven, they're getting rebound. This whole book is getting reconstituted. The whole story. But anyway, okay. All right, now we got to say a word about Beatrice, because we didn't do this in the end of Purgatory. And the truth is, I should have spent a little more time on it. But so what happened, if you recall, is he's been being guided by Virgil, human reason, through hell and purgatory. And then all of a sudden he gets to the terrestrial, back to the Garden of Eden, the earthly paradise. And freaking Beatrice is standing there. And this is the reason he's been doing all of this. Remember in the beginning, he was like, I don't think I really want to do it. And then somebody said, Beatrice sent me. Oh, okay, for Beatrice, I'll do it. God, not for God. But there she is, Beatrice, and she's the epitome of feminine, womanly grace and virtue. The true Beatrice died at the age of 24. We think he only met her 3 or 4 times, but he was a poet, so he idealized her. And in his mind, she was the closest to a perfect person he had ever met. Anyway, so what happens when he sees her in Purgatorio for the first time, and he's like, Beatrice, and she's like, snap out of it. We're not going to do that. But then he looks at her, she takes him over to Christ, the griffin, and he's just looking at her and she's glowing with the light of heaven. And then he goes, hey, Virgil. And the text says, but Virgil was gone. So he just lost this guy that he's been with so much and he just disappears. And it's just lovely language. Virgil was gone. Human reason is gone. Beatrice is divine love. She's the personification of divine love. And she's going to be our tour guide through heaven. Now, but she's very tough with him. It's like for divine love, she is not mushy. She's very matter of fact, and she keeps calling him out of his dream-like state. Huh? But basically, the main thing that Beatrice does is gaze upward, and she keeps pulling him, look up, right? Look. And then she explains things. And he said, upward Beatrice gazed, and I gazed at her. I looked at her, and I saw the reflection of the truths mirrored through her. Now, so basically, what's going on in this journey through heaven is we're trying to look at our own story, the human story, from the perspective of love. Like, if possible. And Beatrice is there to help us do that over and over. The problem is you're not seeing it lovingly. You're not seeing it lovingly. And then and sometimes love is tough, but it's always clear. And so she's our guide to teach us how to do that. Now, but one of the things that I love, the description of Beatrice, and there's some beautiful artwork of the two of them. So here's the two of them looking at the heavens, huh? And some of the description that he uses about this relationship between the two of them and everything, and it made me think, Beatrice is that person in your life who points you to heaven. Do you ever have someone like that? Somebody who says, okay, up. Look up, stop, don't, okay. But and not in a kind of mushy, sentimental, gooey way, but a very believing, faith-filled way. And so we should pray for Beatrice, somebody that we just trust is really telling us what they believe. And you can lean on their faith when yours is wobbly. But this is a beautiful thing, huh? C.S. Lewis says, true love is not two people gazing into each other's eyes, but two people side by side gazing out at truth, the world, life, God, whatever, that you have that person beside you. Okay. All right. Let's start with heaven now. Okay. So the first, after they go, whoosh, boom, like they get sucked up, and then they hit the heaven of the moon. They realize they're on the moon. And the first thing Dante says is, okay, why are there spots on the moon? Could you explain that to me? Because we have all these thoughts about it down there. And she's just like, oh, please, of all the things you want to talk about, right? But then he says this, the interesting thing, that they get sucked literally into the moon. Says, it seemed to me a cloud encompassed us, luminous, dense, consolidate and bright as adamant on which the sun is striking. And then he says to her, okay, we're inside the moon. How is this possible? And that opens up this huge discussion of difference. And that God has the ability to absorb without things losing their essence. That this is too much for us. When we think of absorption, we think something disappears. But God, creation is difference. It's difference making. I'm making something distinct from myself. And so God made us distinct from himself and has an interest in preserving that distinction. I don't know about you, but I'm always worried when we go to heaven and we're going to be this amorphous thing. We're going to be sucked into the general energy. And will I even know myself? I mainly want to make sure I know Emily Dickinson when I pass by her. There's so many things I want to talk to her about, right? But no. I think that we hear all these kinds of theories, right? Dante's absolutely adamant that it has to be that our uniqueness is preserved and, in fact, heightened in heaven. Otherwise, what kind of a God would he be? And he says the proof that he can do this thing is first and foremost in the incarnation, where God becomes man, and it doesn't lose his godness, and it doesn't decrease his manness. He's fully God and fully man. So Dante's, if you believe in the incarnation, that is then the type for us in heaven, where we are going to be absorbed into God, but retain our identity. And then he says, and there's one place on earth that we can experience this in life. Anybody take a guess? Oh, beautiful. You're not even Catholic and you got that. Wow. The Eucharist is heaven on earth. How can two bodies meld into one, each remaining distinct? This is heaven. This is the Eucharist. And so when we go to communion, we are having literally a foretaste. We're not going to lose ourselves in heaven. We're going to find ourselves fully unobstructed. That's a relief to me. Now, so here they are. This is another great work of art. And they're absorbed into the moon. And then he becomes conscious that they're not alone and that there's all these faces all around them that are also part of the moon. And this is the level of people who made vows to God that they didn't fulfill. And so they are in this level of the moon. And he says, but why are there dark spots on the moon? And so she basically says, oh, by the way, the reason there are dark spots on the moon is because difference is part of what God is into. that the moon has patterns and shades. That's how God creates. He makes different things. So why are you troubled that the moon has shadows and shades? And she's like, that's part of creation. But anyway, okay, so here they are now, surrounded by all of these people, these souls who have had a problem with broken vows. So broken vows are the sin of omission. And she says, the reason, so Beatrice explains, because he's like, why is this such a big deal? And she says, because God inspires us to make a vow through our lives, especially when we're getting closer to him. That the idea comes to us, I am going to do this for you, God. And that it's coming from God himself. It's a special invitation when people have reached a certain level of relationship with him. And he says, you want to go deeper? Look at Jesus with the rich young man. Rich young man says, what do I do to be saved? Jesus, you know what the commandments say, you know, don't steal, don't kill, love God, love your neighbor, whatever. And the young man says, all of this I've done from my youth. What else? And then Jesus goes, you need to take everything you have and sell it and give it to the poor and come and follow me. There it is. There's a direct divine invitation. And the young man goes, oh. He went away sad. So, for example, imagine how serious could this be? So think of the story of Hannah in the Bible. We just read this in Walking with Purpose a couple weeks ago. But imagine, so Hannah is infertile and she's weeping and she's being mocked by the other wife. And so she says to God, God, if you give me a son, I will give him back to you and he will serve you in the temple, serve your people. Now, of short, lo and behold, she has a son. Okay. And then imagine though, when Samuel reached the age of 8, if she said, yeah, you know what? Just 2 more years, God. I can't give him up yet. And then he reaches 10 and she's, oh, come on. You can't ask me to miss his teenage years. We just want to get him through bar mitzvah. And then he's 14. And then she's, yeah, I got to see him get married. Like, to see, so she would be taking back her vow which Dante kind of is talking about, like it's a credit card thing where you ask God for something and you made a promise, God delivered, and then you backed out. That this is serious, very serious for us to, and especially there's this aspect of when, you know, that it's like God's telling you, this is the next thing for you. And then you going, first, okay, fine. And then no. This is one of the reasons, by the way, that your penances for Lent, the church makes them under pain of sin. It's practice in one way, but this is serious. If you say to God, I am going to give up sweets for Lent, for you to, as a sign of me struggling with my earthly stuff, and I'm going to do that, Lord, I'm going to do that for Lent, enjoying my sufferings with you and the cross. And then you go, yeah, that wasn't really that big a deal anyway. It's just one cupcake. And back out of it. That means you don't really think God is a real person. You don't think he's really up there listening on the other side. So for Dante, this is serious. This idea of that these people at this level of heaven are there because they blew it. The invitations they got to go higher, basically. Psalm says, make vows to the Lord your God and fulfill them. Let all who are around him bring gifts to him who is to be reverenced, right? Who is to be feared. I like reverence better. Now, the woman they meet on this level is Picarda Donati, and he doesn't recognize her at first because but he knows the family. And we actually met, like, one of her brothers is in hell. And then we met another one of her brothers in purgatory. And here she is in heaven. And one of the things Dante's saying here is, it doesn't matter what freaking family you're from. It has nothing to do with your judgment. But anyway, there she is. And he's, what's your story? And she's, I'm here because I wanted to be a nun. And I went into the convent. But my brother wanted me to contract a marriage with a powerful family. So he had me kidnapped away from the convent and forced into a marriage. And yeah, I got married and I didn't live as a nun. And in heaven, though, she's dressed as a nun. But anyway, Dante says to Beatrice, this is not fair. She wanted to be a nun. Why should she be blamed? And Beatrice basically is going to say to him, she could have died to be a nun. If she said, no, I'm going to go back, that they would have killed her and she would have died. But she didn't want to die. So she accepted the will of these bad people. But God would have sustained her in that martyrdom. So anyway, Dante kind of whispers to her, goes up and he says, Picarda, I know the family. Tell me, are you happy here knowing you're like on the moon and there's like Jupiter up there, right? He's, don't you desire a higher place in order to see more and to be closer to God? Aren't you feeling a little gypped here? And she says to him, no. And this is the most famous line in the Divine Comedy. In his will is our peace. I always think if we could have a Christian 12-step group, you know how they always say in AA, I'm Barbara, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Barbara, in his will is our peace. Because that really is, that should be our answer. That should be on our lips all the time. But that idea that the soul is saying, everyone here is here because this is where our journey brought us. And this is where we are. This is where God's will for us here. And no, we're not envious of the people that are higher up. We have no envy here. It's not about that. And so this line, in his will is our peace, I just invite you to say that to yourself a few dozen times over the next few days, in the next 2 weeks, really, as we go through the Passion with Christ. In his will is our peace. You may not always be joyful, but you can always be at peace. So he says this, then it was clear to me that everywhere in heaven is paradise, though the perfect grace doesn't rain down alike on all the souls there, but it's still all paradise. There is no one unhappy in heaven, according to Dante. Okay, right. Now, Beatrice says, so he's like simmering with this, though, before he finally comes to that last thing. And Beatrice says to him, I know you have a problem with this. I can feel it. And she says, this doubt that you are harboring has venom with the power to kill. She says, there's two doubts you have. One is bad. The other one is really bad. And so this one that's really bad, she goes, we're going to deal with this one first, and then we'll talk about the other one. But what is she talking about? She's saying, basically, Dante is sitting there saying, it's really not these people's fault that they had the things happen to them that they did. And basically, he's questioning all of divine justice and mercy. He's saying, aren't people fated? You were born in a family where they beat you. Come on. What chance did you have? You had a crazy person as your parent or whatever. It's not your fault. And basically, what Dante is doing there is he's voicing fate. That we don't really have freedom. And so this is why Beatrice says to him, no, they were on a tough road. And in fact, she says, time and again, my brother, men have run from danger by a path they did not choose, and on it done what they ought not to have done. So the path you find yourself on, yeah, that's whatever has been dealt to you, your lot in life. Tough luck. But it doesn't mean you have no choice. It doesn't mean you're determined or a robot. How creepy is this new breed of robot, by the way? It looks like a person. And I don't know why they're so obsessed with making it look like a person, but they really are. Google lifelike looking robots and you'll see. It's really getting creepy. I know. But anyway, is this thing the same thing as me? Because that's the temptation, isn't it? To say that your situation, your circumstances have literally rendered you robotic and not free. And so that, if you simmer with that, you can end up rejecting all of God's sovereignty, God's plan, any sense of that, your own lot in life, the situation you find yourself in. She says, this is a venom that kills. It's interesting that he's still thinking these thoughts, even in heaven. But remember, Dante isn't in heaven, really, the pilgrim. He's just visiting. He's a tourist. So he still has to technically work himself out, right? But anyway, okay. Now, the second less serious doubt is the question he has, but what if somebody else makes me prone to sin? Can God really judge me? And it's close to the first one. It's a little bit different. But it's still saying I'm not fully responsible. And she basically answers in the same way and says, this idea, the problem you're having is you don't like freedom as an organizational principle. That you think freedom is the problem. because it lets us make screw-ups and do bad things. And she says, no, for God, freedom is the point, because love is possible only because of freedom. So you have to see it through that light. So yeah, she ends with this thing of telling him, both Picarda and Constance, these two who were dragged out of the convent, could have died. And they said no. I love that line of Flannery O'Connor's. She thought she could be a saint if they killed her fast. She thought she could be a martyr if they killed her fast. But what if they don't kill you fast? Okay. They finish with the moon. And then whoosh, they get sucked up into Mercury. And they land on Mercury. And all of a sudden, these souls come around them and start dancing. Welcome, here we are, we're the dancing. And we're going to see dancing in several levels. The most shocking one is when we meet Thomas Aquinas, and he's totally, you know, what else would a theologian do? He's got all his questions answered. So there he is, right? But at this level, these are the people who were seekers of good and justice and honor. So all of these souls in heaven are people we should learn from. We want to learn from Constance and Picarda. It's not that they're bad. They wanted to be nuns. It's just they fell, their courage failed them. Huh? So in this level, on Mercury, is all the people who gave themselves to pursuing justice. Which is good, right? But somewhere along the line, it became a little bit about them and their honor, and they forgot God a little bit. The cause made, they're doing the cause for God, but then somehow they lose God a little bit, and it becomes the cause. And so the one that we meet is this Emperor Justinian, who was, in Dante's mind, the greatest Roman emperor. He codified civil law, basically made Rome this just state, the most just. And yet he got so wrapped up in a just code of law that maybe forgot a little bit that it was God really running the show. Now, so yeah, so one of the ends up people that he ends up ranting about at this in this canto, Dante is ranting about the Ghibellines and the Guelphs again. Because what he's saying is, from this place in heaven, I can see I was such a committed white Guelph. And we were so sure we were right. And we were the just ones, and it was for the good of the world. But it became like my identity, my cause. And so he says this fighting that then, you know, that when you throw yourself into even a just and noble cause, and it becomes like God needs me, this is my identity. And it's no, it's the Lord's world. And it's him who we honor and serve, not the cause. And so he says that the problem is that when you get too caught up in your cause, you can lose love for the other. You begin to see the other as enemy. And the enemy, the other is Jesus's beloved child or brother. They're not the enemy. And that dysfunctionalism causes this problem a little bit. So we are meant to be giving ourselves to the pursuit of justice, but we should be tempered always with this calmness, which tells us it is God's world. It's God's world. He loves it more than we do. And so very fine distinction there. Okay. He makes the point that human governments will ultimately always fail. They will always fail because man is essentially ungovernable because he is prone to factions. And he throws in Adam and Eve all of a sudden as if to say, if God couldn't organize Adam and Eve, who do you think you are to organize 330 million people? And that this should give us a bit of peace. It reminds me of St. Augustine writing the City of God after Rome is sacked like the second or third time, I forget. In the fourth century, Rome is sacked three times. And the church goes crazy because everyone thought Rome is the new Jerusalem. It's the center of Christendom. And then the barbarians sack it. And they're like, "This, what does this mean? It's the end of the world." And so St. Augustine says, we have no earthly city. You get that, right? There's no country that is Christendom. Find the best one you can and support it and do your duty, but never lose sight of the fact that your citizenship is in heaven. Then he goes on this long speech, even though he said all that, that Rome does have an eternal destiny. And he does this whole history of Rome from the standpoint of God using it as a place from which he is going to continue to reveal himself. Very interesting thing. And that God is using the sacks of Rome and the failures of Rome and the mistakes and all of that, and it keeps, but still Rome is going to be the new city of where he set his temple up. Take that, Martin Luther. Okay. No, good. All right. So the last one is Venus, and this is, we're going to end here. They get sucked up and they end up on Venus, which as is where women are from. But Venus, these are souls who were in danger of getting into Eros. That they loved people almost too much. And the way they get saved is they are able, through God's grace and inspiration, to transfer this furnace of love they have in their heart into charity. So it doesn't become about themselves replicating themselves and their own emotions and feelings. It gets turned outward. And yet, these souls they love the stuff of the Lord. And so it's just slightly shadowed. But that is their big lesson, is if I can't be with the one I love, I'm loving the one I'm with, huh? To quote a song, but no, that idea of I'm going to supernaturalize all of the affectionate feelings of my heart. I'm gonna like when I feel my heart drawn to someone, I'm gonna see it. What is God? Where is God in this? What is God saying to me? And how can I make this? If Jesus was here in me, what would he do now? But that idea of converting the potentially selfish, needy love into being a medium, a place for, okay, Jesus, I'm here, work through me. And that is their salvation, these souls. So quite beautiful. Any thoughts, comments? Any comments on heaven as we've begun here, or anything? Yeah.
Earlier, you were like your path that God is. One thing about St. Vaquita that I was reading, which I can't get my head around, is they ask her, what would you do if you met the slavers and the slaveholders that she was with? And she said, I would get on my knee and kiss their hand because that path led me to Christ and to her life. But I can't get my head around that.
But, I know. Wow. Difference between her and me. I would be like, I'm sorry, but some people are toxic and I need to separate myself from them for my own good. Yeah, that's the difference, isn't it? The saint, yeah. Thinking, they're thinking with a perspective of divine love, not the way we tend to think. Jesus says it to the apostles. You're thinking like men think, not like God thinks. And that's the next 2 weeks, isn't it? The challenge of the passion and death is to think like God thinks. We can wallow in it as human beings and think of how it felt and to be scared. And those things can help us. But in the end, it's to ascend that for us and to see it as God sees it, which is, as St. Paul says, you know, this is Christ, a man, paying off the debt of humanity and satisfying that terrible crime. That's what's going on, really. So let's spend the next 2 weeks being in awe of that and full of gratitude. Good. Okay, so we'll take heaven part two next week, and then we'll finish on in 2 weeks. Anyway, thank you very much, everybody. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy Podcast. The music for the podcast is provided by George Serra. Learn more about his music in the show notes. Until next time, be well and God bless.